argument from the petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is Bob Wooldridge. With me is Mr. John McReynolds. We represent the petitioner, or the petitioners in this case, who were the defendants in the trial court, and those petitioners are Dallas Power and Light Company, Texas Power and Light Company, Texas Electric Service Company, and Texas Utilities Generating Company. All of those companies are part of what is known of as the Texas Utility System, a system that provides electric utility generation in a large part of the state. This suit arises out of a coal and lignite lease in which the plaintiffs in the case were lessors and the defendants, who I represent, were the lessees. All of the issues in the case relate to the question of whether or not there can, or even must, exist an implied covenant of reasonable development, and the question of what remedy there would be for the breach of any such implied covenant. By way of background, the defendants, as I mentioned, have an obligation to provide electric service in this state. And part of that obligation to provide electric service requires the obligation that it provide a continuing source of supply of electric energy. And that requires that our clients acquire and maintain and hold fuel supplies sufficient to provide that electric generation. And it is part of that responsibility that brought about the acquisition of these leases by these electric utility companies back in the 1950s and the 1960s in an effort on the part of those companies to acquire fuel, alternate sources of supply of fuel, to be able to provide that electric service. I think as the court knows, those companies have pioneered the development of lignite in the state of Texas.
Counsel, let's get to the problem in the case.
All right, sir. After receiving payments for many years under the terms of these leases, the plaintiffs filed this suit, and this suit was for the purpose of canceling those leases. We believed, and we still do believe, that plaintiff was seeking something that they were not entitled to as a matter of law. And we filed a motion for summary judgment predicated upon the language of the leases, which I'll discuss in a moment. The trial court granted that summary judgment and the plaintiffs appealed. And in the Court of Civil Appeals in Houston, the trial court was reversed in part as to 11 of the leases and affirmed as to the other two. And the Court of Civil Appeals determined that as a matter of law, an implied covenant does exist in these leases. And we think that's in spite of the language to the contrary in the lease. They also indicated, or perhaps even directed, a conditional decree of cancellation upon remand to the trial court upon the determination of what would be a reasonable period to develop. It is our position that the issue in this case is really not that complex. The parties contracted freely and openly. There is no allegation by the plaintiffs in this case of any fraud or overreaching or misrepresentation in connection with the obtaining of these leases originally. I don't believe there's any dispute in this case that if the parties did so contract and did so agree, then they should be bound by those provisions of that contract and that the sanctity of that contract should be upheld. It has also been acknowledged, and I think it's undisputed, that there can be no implied covenant of reasonable development if there has been an express stipulation upon the point that is at issue in the leases. The Danziger case, the Freeport Sulfur case, the Link case, and all those other cases very clearly hold We believe that such is the case, that the parties do have that right to contract away implied covenants. I believe it's also clear that this general proposition, the right to freely contract, applies specifically to covenants to reasonably develop in mineral leases. The Lab or Labia versus Magnolia decision specifically directed itself to the question of whether or not the parties were free to so contract as to the question of development, and determined that they were. Now, with that background, we then have the question in the matter of looking to the lease for the purpose of determining what the intention of the parties were at the time this was entered into. And as the court, this court said in the Freeport Sulphur decision, it is a matter of interpreting that writing and ascertaining the intention of the parties therefrom. And it seems to us that that's where we are now. And at that point, I would like to call the court's attention specifically to the lease language. Mr. Burnett has been kind enough to type a page, which you have up there, which contains the language out of the Court of Civil Appeals. And I would point out to the court that there are actually three different ways in which the parties have expressed what the intention of the parties was in connection with this matter of the obligation to develop, and to the matter of what is the effect of not developing. The lease specifically says that it shall not be forfeited for any failure to prosecute mining operations. It says further that it shall not be forfeited, and forfeiture shall not be claimed or enforced for the breach of any implied covenant. And then it goes further, third point, to point out what the parties are trying to say in that language. But the title to the minerals in said land hereby leased shall not revert to lessor or his assigns so long as the annual rentals is herein provided for are being paid to lessor. Saying clearly, I believe, and I think it's clear from the language itself, that the thought that there was an obligation to prosecute mining operations on behalf of the lessee is made clear that that was not the purpose when they say not only that there shall not be any forfeiture for that, but also say that so long as rentals are being paid, that the leases shall not revert to the lessor. There's some additional language that is not on that page, which says again, so long as lessee pays to lessor the lease rentals herein specified, lessee shall have and is hereby granted the exclusive right to such premises. So long as the rentals are paid, the lessee has the exclusive right to the premises. We believe that the expression of the intention of the parties is clear from this language as to what they intended and what was meant in connection with the obligation to develop. I would point out to the court that there is no language in any of these leases upon which you could use to support the idea that there is an obligation to undertake mining operations. The Freeport Sulphur case, the discussion there is to the idea of looking to the intention of the parties from the instrument itself. And there is no language in this instrument which would indicate that the parties desired or contracted that there should be mining operation obligation upon the lessee in the case. What the plaintiffs are undertaking to do by this suit is to bring this lease to an end, however way you want to call it, but to bring this lease to an end for lack of development or for the failure of the lessee to undertake development. What the plaintiff is seeking to do in this case is to imply a covenant when the lease says there shall be no forfeiture of this lease for breach of an implied covenant. What the plaintiff seeks to do is to say that the provisions that say that as long as the rentals are paid, lessee has the right, should be written out of this lease. And that there should be inserted instead of, and contrary to that language, an obligation on the part of the lessee to do something which the lease clearly does not contemplate on its face.
Counsel, how long does the company anticipate that it would take to get around to developing this lease?
Your Honor, the nature of lignite is such that its development is not at all like that of oil and gas. It is a circumstance in which, of course, there is a very limited market for it because it depends upon the utilization of it in connection with the operation of a plant. Our clients have developed a lot of lignite resources, which, if this case were in the trial court, we would show are easier mined and deeper seams and the like such as this. I cannot answer the question specifically as to when these particular leases would be developed or by whom they would be developed, whether it would be by this present lessee or by an assignment to somebody else who would develop.
I think what the courts have done in the past, where it looked like the lessors have been taken unfair advantage of, the courts have not hesitated to find an implied covenant to go on and develop. What happens, it occurs to me in this kind of case, is that if it's too long, then your delay rentals amount to nothing. And the poor lessors are sitting out there wondering whether they can do anything with this land or they're going to have it dug up the next day. And I think one of the questions that this court has in mind is whether or not this has been a fair and equal treatment of both parties.
I'd like to respond to that. First of all, I do not believe that there is anything in the record before the Court of Civil Appeals or before this court that would support the proposition that the plaintiffs in this case have been treated unfairly. The record shows that rentals on this have been paid for some 20 or 25 years. In connection with this obtaining of lignite. And we know what the history of lignite has been over that period of time and what the nature of the development of that lignite has been. And I would submit that if we had that issue in the trial court, and at the very least, that question is a matter of the trial court, I think the Court of Civil Appeals erred in going a step further in finding as a matter of law and implied covenant. But it would be shown that these leases were acquired at a time when nobody was acquiring lignite, and that the plaintiffs in this case were being paid the delay rentals when nobody else in the state had any interest in lignite, and all that period of time, and would also go further to show the reason and the necessity, unlike oil and gas, for the acquisition of lignite in the manner in which it's done. So I don't think there's any question of unfairness. I think, secondly, we have the situation in which the parties, at the time that they entered into this contract, could have negotiated many other things than perhaps they did. They could have provided for escalation, or they could have put a 20-year term, or done a lot of things. But the parties did not do that. The parties agreed that they would accept this money, and that as long as these money was being paid by the lessee in this case, then the lease would stay in full force and effect. And I would submit to Your Honor that it is not unlike the circumstance, and I know what you mean by the period of time, where parties can contract for extended periods of time on fixed prices, such as a lease, an office building, or such as a gas purchase contract. But at the time, the price seemed like a good one. And as time goes on and circumstances change, and here changed, I believe, from the standpoint because of our efforts, the bargain does not appear to be as good as it once was. And I think Summers on oil and gas, and the quotation that's in the brief there, and the language that is contained in the Weed opinion, set out that the parties have the right to so bargain with one another. That they have the right to say that as long as you make those payments, when you make them, that you can continue it forward. So I don't believe there's any evidence, and I don't believe that there is any inequity in this situation. And I believe that the parties under the law of this state and under the decisions of this court have the right to so contract, and if circumstances change that the bargain may not appear as good at one time as the other, that is not a matter we believe in the intervention of the court, and that the sanctity of the contract should be upheld.
Well, maybe you would like to address what's the difference between the oil and gas leases and lignite leases. Is it that oil and gas can be drained away and that lignite is going to stay in place?
That's definitely one of them. The nature of oil and gas is of such a type that you can have the circumstance of drainage if you do not develop within a certain period of time. A landowner two ranches over can drain the oil and gas under your property. And so a covenant is implied in those leases in connection with the matter of drainage. That situation does not exist with lignite. That's there, it's in place, it's going to stay in place, and you don't have that problem. Secondly, in connection with those matters, are the cases that I think this court is most familiar with that talk in terms of what is the real nature and what is the intention of the parties. Did they really desire to obtain royalties, or was there something else in addition to that? This lease, these particular leases, provide very clearly that it's not just a matter of royalties in connection with the manning of lignite, but it's also the matter of the paying on an annual basis under the circumstances of which the lessee does not have the obligation to go in there and mine. And the court decisions, the recent decision in Weed, uphold that as being proper and a proper subject of contract between the parties. So I think there's two differences there. And it is our thought that because of that, the Court of Civil Appeals errs when not only does it say there can be an implied covenant in these leases, but says there is one. There is one in spite of this language to the contrary. There is one in spite of the fact that the plaintiff, in this case, didn't file a motion for summary judgment and didn't ask for that, and said, as a matter of fact, to the contrary, we think there's a fact issue that exists on the question of whether or not there's an implied covenant. In spite of the fact that there is no record on that issue here, and none made in the trial court on that issue because there was not a motion filed in connection with making that determination. I would submit to the court that what should be looked to is what is in the mind of the parties at the time these leases were taken. They say you can't claim an implied covenant. Plaintiff says you can't. They say you can't forfeit for failure to mine. Does that mean that you can? Plaintiff would say that you can still write that in there. It says that the lease remains as long as the rentals are paid. Plaintiff says, that's not so. We need to change that and impose a new, totally new, and a totally different obligation upon the parties. Case is cited. Stevens County case and the Texas Company case, I would submit, are not in point at all. In neither one of those cases was the issue addressed at all. On the question of whether or not parties can contract for the payment of rentals to continue the lease in force. And to the contrary of that, we have the numerous decisions which are cited which say that the parties can contract away this matter of reasonable development. I think it's clear what the parties intended. They intended by this language that this lease was not going to come to an end because of failure to develop, failure to manage. They intended from this language that this lease should not terminate because of that reason. And that's what that language is designed to do.
Well, Captain, let's just suppose that there was another way of getting lignite out of the ground or utilizing the lignite other than strip mining, for instance, of burning it under the ground to produce energy. Would there be an implied covenant to develop in cases like that where you might burn out underneath the lessor's land?
I don't think it really turns on the question of whether or not it's strip mineable or not. I think it does turn on the question of the nature of the type of man. I think in the circumstance we have here, and again, if we were in the trial court on this question, we'd be in a position of showing that the only feasible method is extraction by strip mining. Now, you know, if you change the nature of the operation in lignite to say that it would do the same thing, flow in the same manner as oil and gas. And of course, you don't have, and you're not entitled to, in this state, slant hole drilling to get under somebody else's property to take theirs. The difference is that the oil flows under the property of the neighbor. You're not going to have that situation with lignite. That lignite's not going to. I think for that reason, if none other, then there is a difference between the nature and the reason for a covenant of implied development. And that issue, I would submit, is where the Court of Civil Appeals, I think they erred in the beginning, but they went further to say what the Court of Civil Appeals said was the proof presented shows that there was an implied covenant. The only proof presented and before the Court of Civil Appeals in this case was the lease, or the leases in question. And there is nothing in those leases in question that gives any rise or indication to the implication of an implied covenant on the basis of necessity. And there are the cases which discuss that that's why you imply a covenant. It's because it's necessary to do so. Or on the basis that the parties must have intended that and then therefore did not need to write such into their agreement.
There's no discussion of whether or not a reasonable, prudent operator would have developed or not developed, is there?
That matter, we didn't feel we needed to reach because of the language of the lease. It would seem to me that all of those elements might very well apply to the question of whether or not there should be an implied covenant, and that it is not as a matter of law that that's the case, and that there has not been a showing based upon the record in case that that's the case.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
I've been listening, and I'm not sure I understand what your answer to the Court of Civil Appeals is when they say that the lease provision you're relying on heavily and have read to us says what your obligation is not, but it doesn't say what your obligation to develop is. And the police are silent about that. And they go on and quote the Weed case, which you also rely on, as saying, yes, we'll uphold this no-term lease, but This doesn't mean that they can delay an unreasonable length of time. And then they say that's a question of fact for the jury. How do you answer the question that even though you have a no-term lease that says you can only preserve it with, that you can preserve it by the payment of delay rentals, that it doesn't mean you can just indefinitely delay the purpose of the lease, which is to develop the mineral for an unreasonable length of time?
Your Honor, first of all, the lease itself, I believe, speaks directly to the obligation to manage. I just have to disagree with the Court of Civil Appeals when it says that it doesn't. It speaks to what the obligations of the parties are. And it speaks to it not just from the standpoint of the discussion of forfeiture, but it speaks to it from the standpoint of saying what the obligation is. And that is, if you pay, and you pay on an annual basis, as required in the lease, then you do not have the obligation to manage. Plaintiff would say, yes, you do have the obligation to manage. So I disagree on that part. From the standpoint of the second part of that, the Weed case did not involve and did not address, and there was not raised in that case, and the opinion of the court says that there was not raised in that case, the question of the implication of a covenant. Yes, they did discuss that that would be a circumstance, but they did not address that issue.
So you disagree with Reed, with Weed case to that extent?
I don't know that I disagree with it, because it did not address, in my opinion, the issue of whether or not there is an implied covenant of reasonable development. It said that matter was not raised. And it went further, and the court says, we don't know what the circumstances would be, and those circumstances would depend upon the case. And we're here. At this time saying, in this circumstance and in this situation, the parties addressed that issue. And they addressed it specifically, and they said you can't do away with this lease.
Are you prepared to say that they intended, by virtue of their words, that it never had to be developed?
As long as payments were being made, I'm saying that that's what they said. That so long as lessee pays to lessor the lease rentals herein specified, lessee shall have and hereby is granted the exclusive right to the premises. Very clear, unequivocal, two times in the lease, that's what the party said. As long as you pay, you're entitled to possession of the premises. Or as long as you pay, there shall not be a forfeiture. And in this case, and with these leases, the parties have addressed that issue and addressed it very specifically, I believe, from the standpoint of saying that is not an obligation here. And I don't think what I'm arguing conflicts with Weed at all. As a matter of fact, Weed very clearly supports the right of the parties to still contract with one another. I might also, at this point, address this issue of remedy for a breach. We believe that notwithstanding any other argument that might be made, the lease does very clearly address this question of remedy. Plaintiff in the case says he's not seeking damages. They're too speculative. He says and alleges that he is seeking forfeiture. And then he has alleged alternatively a conditional decree of cancellation, and says that a conditional decree of cancellation and forfeiture are not the same thing. Looking at the intention of the parties, I think it's clear from that intention that the circumstances here are that the parties intended that the lease would not come to an end at that period of time, whether you call it forfeiture or breach. Unless you have a question.
Thank you, counsel. Any arguments from the board? From the respondent? Excuse me.
May it please the court, Mr. Burnett, will present arguments to the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm William L. Burnett from Houston. The issue in the case is involved the construction of the controverted language that we've asked the bailiff to put before each of you. This is the only language in these leases, these 11 total lignite leases that are at issue. which speaks, if at all, to the obligation of the lessees under these leases to mine and develop the mineral. If I might rephrase the language, we would like to make three points in connection with the issue of whether this language precludes implication of development covenants in these leases. First, that the holding of the Court of Civil Appeals that this controverted language did not preclude implication of development covenants and did not absolutely preclude the lessors of these leases from resorting to an alternative decree to enforce breach of that implied covenant was correct. Second, that in so doing, the Court of Civil Appeals was not granting summary judgment to the lessor. And thirdly, that if this court should determine for whatever reason to sustain the points of error of the lessees, either number two or three, and hold that this controverted language in effect precludes implication of a development covenant, and decide to reverse the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals on that point, we ask the court to apply its own rule that in that situation, the court will look to the brief of the prevailing party in the Court of Civil Appeals to determine whether there are other grounds on which the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals may be affirmed. And we would point the court to two such portions of our brief in the Court of Civil Appeals on which we feel that the judgment could be affirmed if the court decides to sustain points of error two and three.
What are they?
Your Honor, those points are, I'd like to cite into our brief and tell you, first the point is, in our brief on page 22 and 23, that even if this controverted language be decided by the court to be express language, which precludes implication of development covenant, nevertheless, the effect of that would be only to lower the standard by which the lessees must perform under this lease from the prudent operator to a good faith test. And Calvin, against Broderick and Calvert, decided by this court, decided in our brief, the controverted language there provided that the lessee, the left development of the lease by the lessee to his absolute discretion. And the court said, no, that doesn't mean that you never can develop the, or never have to develop the lease, but that what that means is that you'll have to exercise good faith in developing the lease. And as we pointed out in our opposition to the motion for summary judgment, the issue of whether the lessees have exercised good faith in developing the lease is a fact issue, which would
reach. Is that an oil and gas lease, or is that a lignite lease?
Your Honor, that is also an oil and gas lease case. The second point is from our brief on page 15 through 18, that if the court should determine that this clause, again, precludes implication of development covenant, and the summary judgment evidence does show that the lessees have used this clause in these printed leases prepared by them and all their leases throughout the state of Texas, then and in that event, the insertion of the blanket insertion of these types of clauses, which preclude the implication of development covenants, which the law imposes to protect the lessor, even to balance out in a situation where where a mineral lease is signed, then it would in effect do away with implied covenants, which were designed to protect the lessor.
Counsel, I can understand the broad justice of this. I can also understand that where we are heading is that all lignite deposits must be developed now. And that just can't be done. But what is concerning me is people have the right to contract, and they have the right to make a bad contract. Now, you're talking about an implied covenant to develop. And these parties have agreed that no forfeiture shall be claimed or enforced for the breach of an implied covenant. Now, what do we do? Do we just close our eyes to what these parties contracted about?
Not at all, Your Honor. What we're saying is that this language does not accomplish what the lessees say it to accomplish. It says that there will be no forfeiture. Now, forfeiture is a recognized remedy in the mineral field. What we're saying is that they didn't say that forfeiture would be the exclusive remedy. And we're saying that enforcement of a breach of the implied covenant by an alternative decree is not the same as forfeiture.
Alternative what?
an alternative decree of cancellation.
What's the difference between cancellation and forfeiture?
Forfeiture is an outright determination that the lease is over with and at the end of it. Send the party's home.
If it's canceled, the same thing happens, doesn't it?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily. An alternative decree of cancellation is more in the nature of specific performance. It says, lessee, you have a reasonable time within which to perform your obligation.
And if you don't...
Otherwise, it will be canceled.
If you don't, you're dead.
Right.
Canceled or forfeited, it doesn't make a difference with it.
Right, but the charge is, it's a type of specific performance. It's the charge is with the lessee. He can either perform his obligations within the reasonable time that the fact finder determines, or the lease will be forfeited. Alternative decree can result in forfeiture, but it does not necessarily have to.
Is your problem with the word forfeited, if it said canceled, would it be different?
If it said canceled, we'd have more of a problem, but I still think cancellation and forfeiture are identical. I think an alternative decree, again, by its nature, is a form of specific performance and is different from either outright cancellation or outright forfeiture.
Is there anything illegal or unconstitutional about the provision, assuming it says there should be no cancellation or forfeiture or failure to impliedly develop? Is there anything unconstitutional or illegal about that?
Nothing illegal about it, Your Honor, although a Texas case has held unenforceable a provision that in a oil and gas lease that there shall be no action for damages for breach of an implied covenant. But I wouldn't extend that to a non-forfeiture clause because I believe they're pretty well, they've been held valid in mineral leases. What we're saying is that they spoke to a particular remedy, forfeiture. Alternative decree, we allege, is not the same thing. And if they would have provided that forfeiture was the exclusive remedy and that there should be no forfeiture, well, then we'd have a problem. But since they didn't spell out that forfeiture was the only remedy and that we won't have it, then we can resort to the remedy of alternative decree.
But, Counsel, what's bothering me is that it just appears that the Court of Civil Appeals, in deciding that there was an implied covenant to develop, has crossed two hurdles that I don't know how they got over. One was that there were commercial quantities of lignite that could be produced, and two, that a reasonable, prudent operator would have developed them. Now, it seems to me they have to get over those hurdles, and those are both fact issues. And I don't understand how the Court of Civil Appeals got over those. You want to speak to that?
Yes, Your Honor. The court, I believe, applied the law that in Texas, which applies both to oil and gas leases and to solid mineral leases, that if you look in the lease and there's no language that speaks to the obligation directly, expressly, to the obligation of the lessee to develop, then there will be implied in that lease a development covenant. So the only thing that the Court of Civil Appeals, we say, was holding was that this language did not preclude the implication of that type of covenant. Now, when the case is remanded, it goes back, and there'd be fact issues that the trier of fact will have to determine.
Well, now, isn't there a difference, though, between development and an implied covenant to explore? And here the court says develop. Didn't say go out there and see if there really is enough in commercial quantities that a reasonable prudent operator would produce. What this court has said, there is, I mean, it's implied to me, that there is enough in commercial quantity, a reasonable prudent operator would go on and produce, and there is an implied covenant to do those things, to develop, that is, as distinguished from explore.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I believe that this court in the Clifton against Coons case in oil and gas a long time ago determined that in Texas there was only the covenant to explore and the covenant to develop were the same, that there was only one covenant and not two. The application of that case to a solid mineral lease is unknown, but I don't think that the Court of Civil Appeals, I think the Court of Civil Appeals was trying to determine a matter of law that was this language sufficient to preclude the operation of the implied covenant. I don't think it had to get over any hurdle. The summary judgment evidence was that in the mid-50s, three carloads of lignite was mined from some of the lease premises here. I think it would be reasonable to conclude that if the lessees had determined that there was no coal reigniting commercial quantities in these leases, they wouldn't have paid the lay rental to prepare the 25 years. I don't believe that the Court of Civil Appeals had to get over the hurdles to reach the decision that it did reach.
Well, of course, they, you know, there are always new developments in how to use lignite. So that 25 years ago, there may have been no method by which the lignite could be used, but over 25 years of scientific development for the use of that, it may now be usable. So I don't know that your argument that they wouldn't have paid 25 years holds too true.
I understand the court question. The problem, the reason why we're here is that the landowners who are the lessors under this lease are in a predicament where they can't point to a time in the future when either they'll be receiving the royalties that are the true consideration which flows to these landowners for the execution of these leases, or the lessees will turn back to their land and that their land will revert to them unencumbered by these leases. And the reason why we're in this dilemma is because these are no-term leases. And this court in Fox against Thornton defined a no-term lease and gave examples. This case was cited in the Weed case and gave examples of no-term leases as being those involved in the Stevens County case, the Texas Company versus Davis case, and the Rossin against Bennett case, all cases that were discussed by the Weed court. The discussion by the Weed court was dicta, but nevertheless, the Stevens County and the Texas Company versus Davis cases are still the law that when you have a no-term, in this case, oil and gas lease, in the cases discussed by those courts, the lessee cannot delay development of the mineral indefinitely by the mere payment of delay rentals, but the payment of delay rentals will delay that duty to develop only a reasonable time. And so so the second portion of the controverted language, which says that title to the minerals will not revert to the lessor so long as annual delay rentals are paid, because there's nothing more than what any no-term lease provides. And so our position is that the Stevens County and the Texas Company versus Davis and those cases that were discussed in the Weed case provide that in the face of that language, nevertheless, though the payment of these annual delay rentals will not indefinitely delay the lessee's obligation to develop the supremacy. And so we feel that resort to the alternative decree is a fair way to deal with both of these parties to this lease. First, it's fair to the landowner because it will point to have the trier of fact determine a reasonable time and point to a time when he'll receive his royalties or get his land back. It's also fair to the lessees under the lease because...
So the court entered the order that it did. And up we went to the Court of Civil Appeals, and I have attached here as an exhibit the appeal that Mr. Hamill made. Very first thing he talked about on page one of his argument was, y'all have, the court below errs because it's precluding us from paying our legal fees. I mean, he knew. He knew. There isn't any point in saying he didn't know what was being talked about in the ordinary course of business. And how the Court of Civil Appeals zeroed in so carefully on this matter, of course, is very simple. Maybe we need a statement of facts from the Court of Civil Appeals. Because I made an issue in my argument, I can't find the $24,000. I don't know where the money is. And when Mr. Hamill got back up to argue, the court just asked him, well, what happened to the 24? That was paid to you for legal fees, wasn't it? And Mr. Hamill said, well, sure. There's no mystery to that. And so, you know, I guess that's the reason the Court of Civil Appeals zeroed in on that particular point. But, again, I was complaining about more than just the payment of legal fees for the litigation. And that's evidenced by the record in the temporary injunction proceedings, by the evidence that I put on, and by the matters that were contained in my motion for contempt. In the contempt proceeding, I also asked to have the ladies held in contempt for spending money on the bulletin, which is the House organ, for over matters that were unrelated to patriotic and educational, the normal purposes of the society, but were in fact put in the bulletin for the sole purpose of trying to influence the membership concerning this litigation. Now, that's not legal fees. I never did get the Court of Civil Appeals to comment on that. They didn't hold them in contempt for it, and they just refused to comment. So I don't know where it ended up, but I do know that I was happy to quit on that particular point because the folks quit putting that kind of thing in the bulletin, and I need to be here spending all this time and money and all the court's time and this court's time on a contempt over a bulletin. Like, I just want to get on and try my lawsuit. That's all I really wanted to do. But I could never get a fix on this thing. I can't ever get a photograph to be able to try this case because these people just continue on with this massive, pervasive defiance of the law.
In the Weed case, provides that, in effect of that language, nevertheless, those the payment of these annual delay rentals will not indefinitely delay the lessee's obligation to develop the supremacy. And so we feel that resort to the alternative decree is a fair way to deal with both of these parties to this lease. First, it's fair to the landowner because it will point to have the trier of fact determine a reasonable time and point to a time when he'll receive his royalties or get his land back. It's also fair to the lessees under the lease because it does not outright terminate after 25 or 30 years as lease, but it says, lessee, come on into the trier of fact and produce evidence through your experts as to the market conditions, what a reasonably prudent operator would do in circumstances like this. Governmental regulation, what effect it will have on, and have that trier of fact, or try to persuade that trier of fact to give you the longest possible reasonable time that you can possibly get, and develop within that period of time, or have the land revert back to the lessor.
Do you have an alternative plea for damages?
No, Your Honor, we did not. We might be in a better position if we did, but the reason why is because there's no market for this coal and lignite.
Counsel, seems to me that is self-defeating from your viewpoint. It's you say it's there's no market, no specific use for it, but these people have got to spend money to produce it.
Not at all, Your Honor. Not now. Within a reasonable time after a trier of fact determines, well, what would be that reasonable time? In other words, the trier of fact presented to all the evidence now that there's no market for the coal and lignite now would determine, after listening to all the evidence, what a reasonable time would be. It might be 5 years, it might be 10, it might be another 30 years. Contrary to the amicus curiae brief filed by Dow Chemical, it's not an immediate obligation to develop. It's an obligation to develop after a reasonable time. And what is reasonable will be or the evidence will be presented to the trier of fact by both parties as to what would as to when this coal and lignite would be ready to be mined, and the lessee would have all the protections of a litigant when he has a finding by the trier of fact that maybe it's unreasonable or influenced by prejudice of any litigant in the courts of the state of Texas on appeal to attack that finding if it's unreasonable.
Is there anything Pastor Frey asked about gasification that is burning it inside to? Is there anything in the record about state-of-the-art of gasification?
None at all, Your Honor.
Is there anything, assuming Dallas Power and Light wanted to go out and start digging today, could you get an environmental protection permit?
That I don't know. My
Travis County's had some lignite up around Bastrop for years, and they haven't produced a spadeful because they can't, as I understand it.
I'm sure with the use of government regulations, it would take quite some time. But that's another thing. That would be something else that the lessees would show the trier of fact. The Texas and the Federal Surface Mining Act would impose additional delays, and they could pile those delays on top of the ones that would ordinarily be there for constructing and the necessary plant to draw this coal and lignite out.
All you really want us to do then is to say that this is not a lease in perpetuity as long as the labor is paid?
Yes, Your Honor, that's all.
You don't really care how long it is in terms of what this court says, if you get up to the prior fact, but simply to break the no-term lease.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's all we want is to point the lessor to some time in the future, whether it be 10 years, 30 years, or another, or 50 years. The prior fact will determine that these leases are over with, so that these landowners can point themselves or their children to a time when they'll get the benefit of this bargain or get the land back.
If there's no market for it now, why wouldn't it be as a matter of law that they're not breaching the implied covenant to develop? If there's no use for it now, why? It seems like a matter of law they wouldn't be developing.
Well, if there's no market, if there's no market for it now, nevertheless, in the context of the no-term lease, we would still be entitled to some indication as in the future as to when these royalties need to be paid, because the main reason for the lessor and the main consideration flowing to the lessor of these royalties, I don't believe because there may or may not be any market where they can respond in damages now, that would automatically mean that their implied obligation to develop would be breached. But that would be a fact issue that would be submitted to the jury also, is whether they breached the implied obligation to develop. The jury may very well find that they have not breached it.
Counsel, you would have us change this provision so that it would read instead of what it now reads, so that it would read, but a forfeiture or cancellation may be claimed or enforced for the breach of an implied covenant to develop within the time a jury determines to be reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the effect of it. Because of the nature of the a remedy of an alternative decree, which this court discussed in the Wagoner versus Siegler estate, it said that
it bothers me what we are doing to the right of people, which is an inherent constitutional right, to make the kind of an agreement they want to. Go back to the Dartmouth College case.
I understand, Your Honor, but on the other hand, the right to make a contract is not absolute. And this court, in other contexts, will rewrite the contract that the parties have entered into. For example, in an employment agreement, an employer and employee may put in a provision for a restricted covenant that will last for 100 years and cover the world. And when the employee leaves him, the employer's service and goes out and competes with him, and this issue gets before the court's going to say, wait a minute now, we're not going to enforce this covenant because it's unreasonable as to time and area. So we'll rewrite it and say where the employee actually worked, and for a reasonable time, we'll say you can't compete with your former employer.
Do you take the position that the payment to these lessors of 50 cents an acre is a failure of consideration?
Not at all, Your Honor. The payment of this 50 cents an acre to these people, we're saying it is nominal consideration. And the effect of that is that the lease, by the mere payment of nominal delay rentals, should not be held to be held in perpetuity. But no, there's no failure consideration by the payment of these delay rentals. We're just saying they're nominal, and that the mere fact that they are not, and the fact that they are nominal, should not should result in the court looking pretty strongly at this no-term lease and saying, well, this nominal considerations alone will not be sufficient justification in a no-term lease to for them to be able to delay development for in perpetuity for an unreasonable period of time.
This will be a precedent. We write the decision the way you urge. This will impose the burden upon every lessee who owns an oil, a coal and lignite lease to go out and start mining for coal. What are we going to do with all this coal?
First, Your Honor, it will not impose a burden on all lessees, because most of the leases and just about all the new leases have terms, primary terms, 20 years with an option to obtain the Dow Chemical amicus curiae brief at the outset states that all the coal and lignite leases that Dow has have primary terms. The only leases that this will affect will be the no-term coal and lignite leases that are presently held. In the Fox against Thornton decision in 1966, decided by this court in the oil and gas field, the court defined no-term lease and pointed out that it's virtually extinct in the oil and gas field. And I would say that that same thing is probably true today in the field of coal and lignite. It's only these leases that were the pioneer leases, the ones that were executed back in the 50s that have the no term, that we have the problem. Most of the modern leases and the amendments that these lessees offer to for lessors to sign have definite terms. And you don't reach this problem because the lessor can point to a definite time when the development will be there or they'll get the land back unencumbered by the leases.
Well, counsel, I think it's a matter of common knowledge that when you mine lignite, it has a very short life. It has to be used immediately or it becomes worthless. And isn't that what you're asking these folks to do, is to go in there and mine this, bring it on top of the ground, stockpile it, and have it become worthless because they don't have an opportunity to use it?
Not at all, Your Honor. We're not asking for them to mine right away. We're not asking them to mine in the near future. We're asking them to mine sometime, or give us some indication or have a trier of fact give them find what a reasonable time is in the future, not now, not immediately, not before the conditions are right, not as someone who is not a prudent coal and lignite operator will do, but sometime a reasonable time after the trier of fact determines what a reasonable time is.
Are you asking them for an advisory opinion?
No, Your Honor, we're asking for a jury finding under as authorized by this court in Perkins against Mitchell, which was a case in which was decided in our brief, and it was a case in which, in an oil and gas context, an alternative decree was entered based on jury findings.
Is any evidence in the record that the uncertainty under which these lessors allege and find themselves has caused them any damage?
No, Your Honor. There are no indications that have no evidence in the record that has. On the other hand, we argue in our brief that the cloud put on their land by these coal and lignite leases, and the fact that strip mining is the only feasible way now to mine this land, results in these landowners not being able to, for example, obtain construction financing to build a subdivision on their property, or a strip shopping center, or any other type of improvement which may be the highest and best use for all or a portion of their land. So to that extent, they certainly would be damaged. But again, that the amount of damages for that and would be speculative, and so that's the reason why we ask for an alternative decree.
I assume the lease does not provide that the company can mine this and deliver it in kind.
I don't believe it has any such provisions as are contained in oil and gas. By way of conclusion, Your Honor, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals, and such in this situation, in the no-term coal and lignite leases, to fashion a remedy such that that will be fair to the landowners and to the electric utilities that hold these leases, and to point the lessors to a time when they can have the land revert to them unencumbered by these leases, or to realize the benefit of the bargain, the royalties, the main reason for which they signed these leases. And on the other hand, to be fair to these electric utility companies by allowing them to present evidence to a trier of fact to show them to determine a reasonable time within which they can either make perform in mine or sell these leases to someone who can, or these leases would revert to the landowner's land would revert to them, and this problem, which is a very thorny problem from the standpoint of the landowners, would reach final solution. For all of those foregoing reasons, we respectfully request that the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal argument from the petition?
Yes.
May it please the Court, I'd like to respond first, if I might, to this problem presented in connection with the use of the word forfeiture. As I see it, what the plaintiffs say in this case is that while the lease provides that there will not be any forfeiture, the lease does provide that there is a covenant of development that is in the lease, and it provides, and that this court should go further to say, that if later down the road a new covenant which is impressed upon this agreement is not abided by the lessee, then the lessee forfeits his interest. What he's saying is, I'm not asking for forfeiture now. I'm asking for the imposition of a new in this lease, and then if they don't follow that, they should have to be forfeited. The lease says no. The lease clearly on its face says no. In their brief, they use the definition of forfeiture as the loss of some right, privilege, benefit in consequence of having done or omitted to do a certain act, and the deprivation or destruction of a right in consequence of the non-performance of some obligation or condition. Plaintiff wants to impose an obligation or condition upon us and say that if you do not follow that, then your lease is forfeited. Your rights to this property is gone. That is, I would respectfully submit, the definition of forfeiture and the plaintiff's definition of forfeiture. I would like to get back again to this matter of the intention of the parties. Reading the language that's in the lease, it's clear.
Let me ask you a question and then give you an opportunity to make your summation.
All right.
Is there anything in the record as to where this land is with regard to development?
No, Your Honor.
It bothers me a little bit that the 50 cents an acre, you can forever keep people from developing their land. What's your answer to that? I mean, developing for a shopping center or a subdivision. You said there was 50 cents an acre, and you said, well, I'm just real sorry about that.
My answer to that, Your Honor, is paragraph 9 of the lease, which says that if we want to mine that property, that we have to pay $75 an acre surface damages, plus we have to pay the fair market value at the time of any improvements located thereon. Now,
you're not going to get to that for another 20 years. I'm not trying to set you down or anything, but it bothers me a little that, yeah, I'm not going to exercise that. I've got a right. Meanwhile, the landowner can do nothing.
Well, Your Honor, I can't agree that the landowner can do nothing about
its property.
How can you
call a subdivision when you have a right to go in and strip mine over houses?
Your Honor, that property can be developed fully in any way they want to.
They can go out there and spend a lot of money on development, and you come in and strip mine?
And pay them the fair market
value. $75 an acre?
No. $75 an acre, Your Honor, plus the fair market value of that subdivision or that retail shopping center.
Would you tell me what bank might lend the money? I have got a deal for them.
Well, Your Honor, the banks, I would submit, lend money all the time on properties that are the subject of condemnation and can be. And these companies have the right of condemnation. If there was a subdivision there later on, and it is a public interest that is involved, which of course it is in this circumstance, then the circumstances are, and they're willing to pay for any loss or damage suffered by reason of the taking. Money is lended on that basis all the time. And I do not believe that it is an impediment to the development of that property.
Counsel, let me see if I understand what you're saying. What you're saying is if they go out there and build $10,000 to $40,000 houses, that the only way you could go out there to strip mine that area would be to pay the market value for those houses.
That's correct.
Does that include the market value for the real property also, or does $75
an acre? $75 an acre is the value of the property itself. The fair market value relates to the improvements of the property.
And that's paragraph 9 of the lease.
Paragraph 9, yes, sir. Now, I would...
Now, Stephen, go back to your summation, Counselor.
Thank you. I think, Your Honor, that it's clear where we stand here. Mr. Burnett has said and has told this court from this lectern that he wants this court to rewrite this lease. It's not illegal. It's not unconstitutional. There's no allegations in it that it's vague or ambiguous. There is no dispute about the sanctity of the contract. There is no dispute about the right of the parties to contract as they have. But he wants this court to rewrite it and to impose some obligations on the lessee that were not contemplated at the time, as is clear by the language of the lease. And he wants this court to do more than just to add a provision. He is asking this court to change the provisions that are in the contract at the present. The provisions that say what the rights of the parties are. I submit to the court that the law of this state and the decisions of this court are clear that there should be sanctity of that contract. I have a hard time with this discussion of what a predicament these people are in. Because I don't believe that that's a circumstance. There wasn't any contention of predicament for some 15 or so years of payments before there was ever any lignite mined in Texas by the defendant or by anybody else. It is the nature of the development of this lignite and such that in order to be able to orderly develop it, these leases must be acquired in the manner in which they were acquired. I don't see the predicament from their standpoint where they could have either elected not to lease their property or to negotiate a term or to provide for escalation. And they, under the circumstances that existed at that time, elected not to do so. And they now come in at a time later and say, well, we don't think 50 cents is enough, and therefore we want this lease to come to an end. Or we want this court to put a term on this lease when there's not one in there. And I might also point out that these comments that are made in connection with breaking the no-term lease, that this is not an issue that has been raised by the plaintiff in this court. He's on about the second page of his brief. He clearly outlines what his position is, and that is with reference to the breach of an implied covenant. He has not challenged the decision in the Weed case. To the contrary, he relies upon it. The law is clear, I would submit to the court, and that it is not an imposition of anything that's unjust or unfair in any stretch of the imagination. These parties freely contracted with one another, open and above board, and contracted for the nature of the rights that would be acquired by the lessee in these properties. And such being the circumstances, we think that as a matter of law, having so contracted and having specifically directed the lease to the question of these obligations, that the Court of Civil Appeals erred in not only finding that there could be an implied covenant, but certainly erred even more in going further with no proof to support it, I would submit, to say that there is an implied
For those reasons, we would ask that the judgment of the trial court be affirmed and the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on briefs and oral argument for both parties. The court will take a brief recess.
Because if it applies in this case, it applies in every shareholder's derivative action. It presumably means that every time a disgruntled minority of stockholders fire off against the corporation is going to be prevented from using its funds to defend itself. A legal proposition that we find to be remarkably dangerous in terms of its potential impact on minority shareholder lawsuits in this state. Now, to revert just for a moment to the Chief Justice's question, the court may have held that the injunction, by its denial of the application for writ of error of the society, the injunction on its face was not overly vague. And we agreed with it on its face. As we pointed out in our brief, if these relators had expended society funds on a trip to Acapulco or to pay off a mortgage on their house, there's no question they would have been in contempt of this injunction, and the injunction would have been enforceable through contempt of sanction. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is an interpretation of the injunction that has never before been before this court, since the interests of these relators are not the interests of the society, and consequently that this court has never passed upon. And Mr. Hubbard seems to suggest that the relators were the ones who appealed the temporary injunction. Of course, that's outside the record. The fact is that in this instance, as in every other instance involving this litigation, my client, when they were officers of the corporation, went to the executive board, the board of directors of the corporation, put the issue before them and said, what do we do? And in every instance, the issue has been placed either before the executive board or before the membership of the society, there has been substantial majorities for the proposition that we defend this litigation. It is unfounded. It is wrong, and therefore we'll defend it.
Now, is this in the record?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The resolutions themselves. Now, of course, and I'll concede that counsel for the plaintiffs, once the resolutions authorizing the defense of the lawsuit were passed, claimed that there was some impropriety associated with the passage of the resolution. And I would assume if we held another election today to determine whether or not the litigation should be defended, and a substantial majority of the present members of the society voted to keep defending it, counsel for the plaintiffs would again find some reason to claim that that didn't represent the corporate interest. But the point in this case, and the one that we find the most significant, is the question of whether the corporation defends itself with corporate funds in a derivative action cannot be answered by resort to a presumption. It has to be answered by evidence in the record and by a specific finding by a trial judge who hears that evidence as to where tentatively the interests lie. Are the majority right? Is there some probability that their accusations are well-founded? Or is the corporate entity and its defenders right? And is there some probability that ultimately the lawsuit will wash out as being unfounded? And that's what Judge Stapley, I hope, was getting at when he asked, who makes the decision? Who makes the determination? Well, my answer is, initially, it's made by the corporation and its directors, its governing board. And then if the other side doesn't like that, they can go to a trial judge in whose court the derivative action is pending and ask for an injunction. And then if the trial judge declines an injunction, they can appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals.
Very, very simply, the Court of Civil Appeals said these seven items are not on their course of business. You're saying they are.
Yes, sir.
And if you're correct, you're entitled to relief. If you're not correct, you're not entitled.
Yes, sir.
It's
that's
just that simple.
That's essentially it. Now, of course, there may be some significance, as I say, because of the precedential impact of the Court of Civil Appeals' previous opinion. I would hate, for example, in my hypothetical instance where the minority shareholders of Texas Instruments sued the corporation, for some court to conclude that because of that Court of Civil Appeals' opinion, it's inappropriate for Texas Instruments to expend corporate funds to defend itself. But you're right, Judge, it's the interpretation of the language of the injunction. And that language clearly means, substantively, as a matter of Texas law, that these expenditures were in the ordinary course of business of the society. Judge Mullinax found that they were in the ordinary course of business of the society. And the decision of the Court of Appeals to the contrary is based upon an erroneous interpretation of Texas law as it relates to shareholders' derivative action. For all of those reasons, we respectfully suggest that the relator should be ordered discharged. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments for both parties. This concludes the oral submissions.